All right, everybody, this is our second session today. This is our prophet study, in case you haven't noticed. Those of you who recall, last time I was up here about a month ago, we concluded 1 Samuel, the book. Now, as is my own personal tradition, I recap the book after I've completed it. So those of you who are bored with this, that's okay, just shut your minds off. Those of you who are more interested in finding out exactly what we covered in a nutshell, now granted, 1 Samuel is relatively long. I don't think we'll get through the entire book today. It'll probably be broken up into 2 sessions today and the next time I'm up here as far as recapping. So I'll be covering the first half of the book of what we talked about, what we learned from it, what the lessons were, and how we can, what we can take away in our own lives with it. Now, if you notice up here, actually, I'll scoot my little chart forward for those of you who can't see because of obstructions. Sorry, Dave, it makes you harder to see, but oh well. I have a board listed. There are 2 categories here, titled 2 witnesses in general, but there's a prepares and there's a delivers category. Oh, hey, a stick! The power!
The rod of correction.
Yeah, you're not in arm's reach, that's good. 2 witnesses, prepares, delivers. 2 categories. In case you haven't noticed, our God seems to work in patterns. And one of the many things he does is he gives an indication of what his goal is by more than one person telling you. You usually have a second witness or even more in many cases. So the first half of Samuel, of course, this leads on to all of the book. We have people who at one moment or another were the preparer, meaning those who prepared Israel for a deliverer to arrive. Sometimes those individuals then in their later on in their life became the deliverer while somebody else was the preparer. It goes back and forth throughout this book, in case you hadn't noticed. And we'll go through some of these things in some of the chapters because the first few chapters cover all these particular individuals. So I will not be having a reader today, so Jeff will just have to, you know, run around on his own. Now, this, of course, is how, this is my take on it, what I presented on these chapters. This is not necessarily what you grasped from all the chapters when we covered them, but hopefully it will be of some benefit to a few of you. Because I know some of you weren't here when I covered all the chapters, but not that this will be a substitute, but it will give you a general idea of where we came from and where we're going to. So first chapter, 1 Samuel, does anybody recall what happened in chapter 1? Any of the events? Well, first of all, it discusses, we get to introduce to our main character, the person who the book is titled after, and more accurately introduced to his family. Who was Samuel? What was Samuel? Hannah's son. And who was Hannah? The wife of a particular individual. Elkanah was his name.
She had no children.
No children, correct.
But she was crying out to God.
The Bible says that once a year, Elkanah, who was a Levite, took his whole family and brought him up to the temple to worship and to. It's just once a year. Now, as we all recall, the Torah commands 3 times a year. But the Torah does not command your whole family go 3 times a year. It commands the males go 3 times a year. Elkanah and his own family went as a whole once a year. He himself may have gone many times. That doesn't matter. But he brought his wives, brought his children, everybody with him once a year to the temple of God. To worship and to celebrate and to pray for whatever their needs happened to be. So she's absolutely right. So Hannah didn't have a child, was praying. Obviously she was.
Crying out to God, and she actually promised God that she would give him that child if he would give her a child. And that's what she got.
Yeah, to donate whatever child is produced to God. Normally it's not done, in case you haven't noticed. Most of us don't donate our children to God. In the fashion that she does, because it's more of a donation. It's like, oh, well, no, I'll raise him. No, that wasn't the case. Donation means, all right, God, here you go. I get to see him once a year. I imagine us donating our children such that we see them only once a year. That's pretty hard for most parents to do. But that was the offer she gave. Now she was there in front of this temple, and who was observing her? Eli. Now who was Eli? The high priest, right. He was high priest. We don't know his exact age, give or take, probably in his 50s, hard to say for certain. 40s, 50s, somewhere in that range. He could be a little older. So he's observing her, and what does he think when he sees her? She thinks she's drunk. Now, why would he think that she would be drunk? Now, she is standing on the doorpost, or next to the doorpost, of the temple of God. Now, there are certain restrictions as far as who you are, how contaminated you are. It dictates how far into the temple you are or are not allowed to go. Obviously, males typically go further. That was just how it was, how God set it up. But the doorpost is pretty much the limit for almost everybody. There were Levites could typically go further. Now, she was married to a Levite, so her husband could go further into the temple in different areas, but she could not. But she went into the doorpost, praying to God. Eli's observing, thinks she's drunk, and reprimands her. So do you not, go get out of here. You disgrace God's house. That was very ironic of Eli to have stated such a thing, to disgrace God's house. Those of you who recall who Eli was, what he did, what his sons were doing, disgracing God's house would be the least of what a drunk woman would be doing compared to what he and his sons were doing by significant degrees. He reprimands her, tells her, get out of here, go away. She says, no, I'm not drunk, as you suppose. I'm praying for a son, describes what's going on. Eli repents, semi-repents, so he doesn't say, I'm sorry. He doesn't say, God, forgive her, forgive me. He just says, okay, well, whatever you ask for, God bless it. And put her on her way. She went away happy. Because the high priest, the first time, the high priest heard her discuss what she wanted and said, may God bless it. Now, in that particular case, who was the prayer and who got delivered? Or who was delivering? Who was the deliverer? This is a complicated one. It's not quite that easy because both got prepared and both were being delivered. In chapter 1, Eli was the high priest, right? And Hannah needed deliverance. All right? Now, in this case, Eli, as the high priest, both prepared Hannah and delivered Hannah. Okay? In this case, chapter 1, Eli prepared her as the high priest by who he was, what his ability was to talk to and contact God, grant things that only he could do. No other human could do it. So he both prepared, and then she went to him. She had a place to go. He was there. He was able to do this. And then he delivers her by granting the blessing. So you have one man who did both roles. But then what does Hannah become? Once you have a preparer and a deliverer, the next person becomes the deliverer and a preparer, and it goes through a cycle. Preparer, deliverer, deliverer, preparer. They go all the way through. God works through a pattern. He doesn't break his pattern. He sticks with it. This is not just in 1 Samuel. It's in actually numerous books in the Bible, which we're hopefully going to go through most of them. Not all of them, but most of them. So in this case, Eli starts out as a preparer, as a high priest, and delivers Hannah via a blessing. But Hannah does something the following chapter, chapter 2. What does she do in chapter 2? Can we recall chapter 2? What happens? Say it again.
Praise.
Well, let's go, let's see, my little book here, over to chapter 2 here. Let's see if I can get your memory sparked just a little bit as far as who and what she is. That was chapter 3. Chapter 2 is relatively long in my book. All right. She prayed. She prayed to God very loudly, very happily. What does she conclude in chapter 2? She concludes that God counts deeds greater than your words or who or what you are. Relatively new idea, mind you. This is not of course he counts our actions more important than others. Well, wait, that's new for them. That's new in this area. It used to be, you are a descendant of Abraham. Done. God will take care of you because you are a descendant of Abraham. But now she's saying, wait a minute here. It's not just being a descendant of Abraham. Your deeds are what God counts. She concludes this in her prayer. But she prophesies. This is how she becomes a preparer and a deliverer. She unfortunately delivers Eli into death, but that's his problem, not hers. But she prepares the place, prepares the scenario for Samuel to show up. This all happens in chapter 2. So in chapter 2, of course, she's rejoicing, speaking, God, you are like a rock, there is none beside you, the bow of the mighty is broken, men's deeds are counted by him, for the Lord is a God, is not just the God of thoughts. He raised the needy from the dirt, the trash heap he lifts the destitute. He guards the steps of his devoted ones, but the wicked are stilled in darkness. For not through strength does a man prevail. May the Lord those who contend with him be shattered. The heavens thunder against them. May God judge the ends of the earth. May he give power to his king and raise the pride of his anointed one. Hannah is called the first female prophet that actually recorded something, because no, Sarah didn't record anything. What does she prophesy in her statement, in her prayer to God? Do we remember? We talked about this, granted this is about a year and a half ago. We discussed what she prophesied. Prophesied Eli's death. Prophesied the removal of one that God had, and to replace him with one who is now greater or better than him. Who was the replacement? Samuel. Samuel going to replace Eli. She delivers Eli into destruction by her mouth. She prepares him. She tells him, actually, within the prophecy, look, those who are great are brought down low. Who is great? Who is the greatest of all of Israel? Eli. There is no one greater than him. Not even the prophets are greater than Eli. Because there aren't any prophets yet. No one's greater than Eli. There are no kings yet. There's nobody greater than him. So great are brought low and the low are brought up within her prophecy. Who is the lowest? A barren woman whose all of her inheritance and the existence of her identity as she was born and raised are going to be passed on to the second wife's children. She has nothing. She perceives herself as the lowest. She delivers Eli into destruction, but she prepares the way for Samuel to take over. She goes from a deliverer, delivering Eli into destruction. But here's one of the things she does. By delivering Eli into destruction, who did she deliver out of destruction?
Israel.
All of Israel. That's big. Eli and his sons were corrupting, contaminating all the people of Israel, such that God said, I will remove my presence from you, from all of my people. I will destroy my house. I will destroy your line, that no one amongst you will live as a normal life. They will all die young. God commanded that, all because of Eli and his sons. And was he upset with their own personal corruption? Well, yeah, but that wasn't what he was angry about. He was angry that they commanded and they created and put upon all of Israel sin in the name of God. That's a serious thing. To destroy God's name and pollute it with your own identity and desires is not an acceptable or, in this particular case, forgivable by God. Now, we always think like, oh, well, God forgives, God forgives. Yeah, he does, but there's certain things he doesn't forgive for. Openly destroying his name purposefully and intentionally for your own gain. And then when you're called upon it, guess what happens? You do nothing. You say, oh, that's okay. I'll do it, continue to do it. That's not something which he forgives. And he never forgave Eli and his sons for it. Judas is an example with the Messiah. certain things are not forgivable. So she delivers Eli into destruction, but she delivers, in this prophecy, she's prophesying the delivery of Israel out of destruction. Chapter 3. What happened in chapter 3? Do we remember what chapter 3 was? What did we learn in chapter 3? The calling of Samuel. What was Samuel's job? We're going to break up a little bit. Hannah, of course, has a son, names him Samuel, delivers him to the high priest after he's weaned, guesstimate about 2 years old, give or take. Could have been a little older, a little younger, hard to say exactly. While he's in the high priest's ownership or control, what is Samuel's job? This is key, because Samuel's very big on this. What did he do specifically? What was his assigned task? Does anybody remember? Oil lamp? He tended the oil lamp at night. Do you recall the Torah says, on Shabbat, or at, actually any day for that matter, when lamps are lit, they're lit at dusk, or as the evening is approaching, you light the lamps. They are not to go burn out before the sun rises. They must continuously be refed, readjusted, trimmed all night long. Whose job is that? Well, somebody doesn't get to sleep at night. Or if he does, he sleeps in between the time which he has to trim the lamp. I don't know, he doesn't have an alarm clock, not sure how he wakes himself up, but that's okay.
That's a swing shift.
Not an easy shift, I'm sure. His job is to maintain the oil lamp. Make sure the light never burns out. What's so important about that oil lamp? We light one on a menorah over there. That's what it was, a menorah. We light it every Shabbat, every holy day, on semi-holy days. What's so important about this particular lamp? It has a lot to do with who Samuel was and what he did for a living.
Well, for one thing, it shows us where our light comes from.
It does. You're right.
And the light of the world. If you don't have light, you're in darkness or choshech.
What is the symbolism, according to the Bible, of what the oil lamp is? What does the Bible tell you it is? What does the Bible say the oil lamp means this? What does it say? Do you remember? Say it again. Eyes of God. Seven spirits of an angel, the seven eyes of God. They're all the same thing. They repeat themselves over and over and over again. Seven spirits of God, seven angels of God, seven churches, if you wish to argue that title, that's fine. The seven eyes of God. What are they doing? As Ellie pointed out, they're to light and to observe.
Looking.
They're looking. They're observing. They're watching. And you notice the candle flames point kind of shaped like an eyeball in some ways. They're very, very symbolic, and very openly symbolic, of course, what they mean. And Samuel's job was to be there and take care of this thing. And what did God see in chapter 3 with Samuel? What was he seeing? Samuel's the one who tends his eyes. Samuel takes care of his eyes. And what does he see of Samuel?
He's Samuel's faithfulness because he's taking care of it.
Samuel's faithfulness.
He keeps it alive.
You're right. He does see Samuel's faithfulness. Samuel's also calls himself a seer, one who sees visions. He sees God. He sees what God wants and does exactly what God asks of him. He prophesies in that form. By Hannah's donation of Samuel and God granting, of course, Samuel to Hannah, God was asking for somebody who sees. Somebody who can talk to and sees not only, you know, physically see, we're talking about eyesight, but see what God's desire is. See what he wants for the people to do. See the corruption inside of Eli and his sons. And see how to deliver Israel out of it. He's a seer. In that vision that God that he gets, God declares quite openly, I will destroy Eli's house. I will destroy him, his sons, in one day. And guess who's left over? Samuel. Yes.
I was just thinking about, you know, the function of the high priest, of course, to keep the menorah running.
Yes.
But it's interesting now, looking at the Messiah who's in the midst of the candlesticks, and if one of them repent, he takes it away and puts another one in his place. I was looking at Eli. He was the candle, one of them, and he's, I'm going to remove you and put Samuel in his place.
It was more worthy.
It's kind of an interesting way of putting in that, you know, about the high priest and the function of the lights.
You're absolutely right. Essentially, God does put someone who is more worthy, not only in that, not in the case of Eli and Samuel, but also in the case of Samuel and Saul, in the case of Saul and David. someone who is more worthy or more desirable for that moment in
time.
The
heart is where he wants to
be. What he needs, what God needs right. That moment in time. Yeah. He chooses, all right, yes, you were good for then. Once you've accomplished my task that I've assigned to you, I will now replace you with the next person.
I don't want to be replaced.
Don't take offense to it. That's life. That's what God does with us. To him, life is temporary. It doesn't matter if we live or die. It's because it's okay. That's okay. You're just dead. That's okay. Move on. We'll get back to you later. Death is not a bad thing per se. It's not a tragic event like we think it is. Yes.
How old was he? Sam. When he started all of this.
He was donated to the temple, guessed around 2 years old. By the time this event occurs, as far as when he's seeing visions and whatnot, for Eli, it's hard to say. Most have argued he's still pre-20. Teenager, give or take. Teenage years. Hard to say exactly. Because he's old enough to obviously speak, see, and understand what God's doing, and take instruction from Eli. A two-year-old's not going to be able to do any of that. Be able to see and understand visions and record them down in the fashion that actually makes sense and record, hey, I did this, and he actually connect dots while he's writing it down. Take somebody greater than what I would argue is a young child. A five-year-old would have a hard time writing stuff down. A 10-year-old probably get certain things down, but not going to necessarily grab all the symbolism behind it. Teenager is probably about right. Hard to say exactly, but probably about right. When this prophecy occurs in Samuel's life, he's still a young lad. I mean, he's still under the age of 20. But we don't know how young he really is in that group. So in this case, well, that's a little stick here. What's Samuel doing? Is he delivering or is he preparing? Next one down, with Hannah and Samuel. What's Samuel doing? Preparing what? Not yet, not ranking yet. He has to deliver the people. And no, Hannah prophesied that, hey, Hannah will deliver all the people. She prophesied, God will deliver my people out. He will just deliver Eli to destruction. She prophesied that, and God will replace Eli with somebody who is greater than Eli is. As a result, she thus prepared the way for Samuel to take over. By that prophecy, by definition, it prepares the way for Samuel to take over. Samuel needs to become a deliverer. How is he going to become a deliverer? He has to deliver Israel out, and only Samuel knows how to do it. We discussed this a few moments ago, as far as Samuel having the ability to see God, understand what he wants, and actually accomplish what God's desiring. God's using this person as a deliverer, as a Messiah, so to speak. These are all Elijah and Messiah symbolic, in case you hadn't noticed that. So in this case, with the vision from Eli, Samuel, which once was being prepared, is now ready to deliver. He's going from the transition from preparer to deliverer with this prophecy. Going from Eli, your preparation has been set. I am now ready to take your position. Now I will deliver you into destruction as prophesied by my mother. And I will deliver Israel out of destruction as prophesied by my mother. I will become a deliverer. He's going from preparer into deliverer, that stage, in chapter 3. Chapter 4, what happens? Just what I just said. Eli and his sons get killed. And guess what? Samuel has to deliver all of Israel. But something else happens in chapter 4. The Ark of the Covenant leaves. Captured Philistines for 7 months. And God wipes out his temple for 20 years. Long punishment. 20-year destruction. Now, how come God can do that? Doesn't he need high priests? Doesn't he need sacrifices? Doesn't he need holy days observed? Still do that without the temple. They can. It's called an individual. An individual must do what the nation is supposed to do. So in this, when what happens in chapter 4 is that Samuel delivers, actually chapter 4 and chapter 5, Samuel delivers Israel out. Delivers them out of destruction. Delivers Eli and into destruction. And delivers God's house into destruction. But at the same time, in that chapter, by destroying God's house, God's able to rebuild it and deliver it out of its contaminated state that Eli and his sons left it in and destroyed his name. He can now rebuild. He can now be a deliverer once again to all of Israel. Samuel, of course, becomes judge in chapter 4. In the process of the destruction, a lot of Israelites die. The Philistines come over and take over the city of Shiloh. They wipe everybody out. A lot of people die. And we ask ourselves, how is that good? Why would God kill all of these Israelites simply because of the destruction of what Eli and his two sons were doing? Why would God exact revenge upon all of Israel for just three individuals that needed to be revenged?
Cleaning up the contamination.
Purification. Yes, thank you. Eli and his sons contaminated God's own name in the eyes of all of Israel. Because it records, all of Israel knew full well what these men were doing. They knew what their daughters were up against if they ever went to the temple. They didn't go. They stopped going. God's name became a byword. It was despicable. Idol worship would actually have been better in many cases than going to the temple. So God had to clean house. Yes, Joshua.
Isn't that for the same reason like Nadab and Abihu were burned up by the Lord because they didn't represent him right or they didn't consecrate him to the people?
Tried to do something on their own accord.
Yeah.
They had no business doing.
Okay.
Presumption. Sin of arrogance. Being greater than what you really are. So fortunes changed. And of course, this is where we learn something about the Philistines, chapter 5. When the Ark of Covenant's in the Philistines' household, what happened? Remember Dagon? It's that big rock statue. Remember what happened? He faced down the first time, knocked down. And now, when he fell down, what did the Philistines do? Yeah, and did they say, oh, wow, this is a bad thing? Well, yeah, but they then worshipped the ground that the thing fell on. They said, oh, look, he fell down. This ground must be holy. Praise the ground. It's right in front of the Ark of the Covenant, by the way, because he's right off the side of it, and God's watching this thing. Okay, yeah, whatever. So the next time, what happens? Falls down. This time, the head gets lopped off. What's God telling the Philistines? No, by the way, the Philistines, though they are corrupt and have various problems with them, they are still a people that God commanded to come and take over a chunk of this territory many years ago. God commanded them to do so because the people who lived there, the Canaanites, were so thoroughly corrupt. By the way, the word Philistine means invader. That's the Hebrew word. Those who invade, Philistines are invaders, hence they came not from the land, but to the land from somewhere else. God commanded them to take over this territory. The Torah even tells you that. Deuteronomy, actually, of course. God commanded the Philistines to do this because those who were once here were more corrupt than them. God needed the Canaanites, destroyed. Israel took out a large chunk of them, but the Philistines had to take out a chunk as well. So the Philistines are not horrible, evil people necessarily. But what was God trying to tell them in this process? What was that? God is greater.
God is impotent.
Impotent. Essentially, that's exactly what he's saying. Yeah, this rock, this stone that you are now worshiping, and the ground that it fell down on that are now worshiping, how pathetic that may look, is so pathetic compared to what I am. Do the Philistines then grasp, oh, this God of Israel is greater than Dagon? Yeah, they did. They understood, wait a minute. This is all happening because we brought this other one in, and this other one is obviously wreaking havoc upon our own. Did they then stop and say, we should now worship this greater God? Oh, no. We can get rid of the greater one. We like our old one better. So, essentially, he's telling them, yeah, Philistines, this is a greater solution. This is a more powerful scenario. It's a greater God for you. Worship this one instead. But they choose their own willful blindness and say, yes, we understand and see yours is much greater. We're going to just get rid of you so we don't have to deal with it. So they pass it off to the next Philistine town, who, of course, run across a similar problem. Eventually, the ark runs across an open field out away of all the cities, so nobody has to come near it. They don't want to touch it because all they see is destruction of their own gods. But instead of seeing the greatness and how powerful this particular god is, they fear it and run away and go back to what they're comfortable with, the weakness that they grew up with or are raised with. So God's still talking to these people, still working with them, and yet they still choose not to see. Sounds familiar. So Ark returns 7 months later. And of course, remember the story. They listen to the hemorrhoid problems, and a few other issues happen along with it, and some rats and a few other things too. They all ship off into the Ark of the Covenant. They put it inside, which is interesting. They got to open it. Did God kill them? Nope. They're scared of it. He scared them to death, but they opened it. When the ark brings over to Israelite side, what do the Israelites do? They open it. And God kills them. Huh. For those who know much, more is expected. The Israelites knew better. Do not open this. And the 70 men of the 50 different families who were all killed that day at that tiny little town, to which they were praising and having a great time before they opened it, then the ark was then brought from there into a more worthy town, Kiryat Yearim. And what did that happen? Well, they put the ark inside of a house. They put servants in front of it to take care of it, treat it with the proper respect that all of Israel knew was allocated to the God of Israel. And of course, the house was blessed and profusely and taken care of, all kind of stuff. We know the details of that. So just because willful blindness was in the Philistine side, the willful blindness on the Israelite side was still there too. The first people who viewed the ark were willfully blind and said, oh yeah, we know we're not supposed to open it. Open it up. Yes, Tammy.
For all the Philistine foibles, so far as we know, they never opened that thing up.
Well, it's been argued that they put the tumors and the rats inside. They're inside the ark now.
On it.
They put it. Well, nah, that's debatable. We know that they're currently supposed to be inside of it. One could argue they didn't actually do it. Maybe the high priest put them in. Somebody put them inside. But all we know that they're inside of it now, wherever it may be, in current modern day history. I figured that the Philistines did it, but I could be wrong. Maybe the high priest did. I don't know why he would do such a thing, but that's his business. But the Philistines did certainly touch it. Israelites were killed for touching it. So there are some distinctions that God does put on one group versus another group as far as what you know and how significant of a punishment you get for not doing what is right. So be careful what you learn regarding God.
You're held more accountable for what you know.
You are held more accountable. That's the whole point. Just because God blesses you doesn't mean you're not responsible for taking care of what is right. Yes.
I also wonder if the Philistines knew or had remembered the story of the Exodus and this kind of thing, or they probably arrived shortly thereafter. But if they would have known any of that history, I could see why they would have been scared. Like, okay, these are the small things,
mm-hmm.
You know, the boils or the
the issues, right?
But that he could kill us eventually, because that's what happened in Egypt. Those plagues started out kind of small,
and they grew,
and they kept growing and growing and growing until there was death. So.
Right. Which is one of the reasons why most have argued as to why rats were included, golden rats were included with the return of the ark. Because what do rats do? Well, not only do they declare plagues and diseases, they also eat a whole lot of food. A lot of your stored grains. And what happens when your stored grains are consumed up? You starve to death. So they could have, had they not returned it after the 7 months, there's a good chance they may have gotten a whole lot worse for them. But the Philistine high priests of Dagon concluded it was good to get rid of it. So kudos to them for keeping their eyes open, I guess. Yes.
It says that 50,000 and 70 were killed.
Right. Here's the deal. This is This is debatable. We don't know for sure yet as far as the exact quantity. 50,000 or 50 clans. We don't know that it's actually thousands in humans or thousand clan means families. It's the same word in Hebrew. 1,000 in a family is the same word. So what is argued is that it's 70, whatever it is, of 50 families. So 70 is that? It's 1, 2, 60? 70 and 10. Is it 70 and 10 or just 70? It's 70, right?
Right.
70 people,
but,
yeah.
But they all didn't look in the ark. I mean, it was...
No, that's why only 70 were killed.
The leadership looked
well,
in
well, those who were responsible, most likely the 70. And the reason I think it's 70 is because the town that was there, there aren't 50,000 people that could be supported by that land. And they could be supported by a 50-mile radius of that land. It's on a mountaintop or near a hill. There isn't a lot of grain. You couldn't grow a whole lot of stuff. But we're not like modern cities like today. Could you imagine supplying food required for, what, a third of Santa Rosa? How much territory would that require? Well, the average person consumes 1 acre of land a year. That's just subsistence level, meaning you're not starving to death. You got a lot of acres in order to support a town. Of course, it has obviously a lot of other things, too, associated with it. So 50,000 deaths is stretching it. 50 families, that makes sense. 50 families make sense. There aren't that many that in necessarily a family. You could have 10 people in a family. You could have 20 people in a family. You could have 1,000 people in a family, theoretically, but that's a really big family. Most likely, there was a little bit smaller. So it's argued that it's most likely, instead of 50,000 and 70, that it was 70 from 50,000 families, or 50 families. So anyway, that's side point. If you took out 50,000 people, you wiped out a good chunk of Judah. A little over half the tribe of Judah would be dead. That's a big chunk of Judah. Considering they just went through, a 10,000 person loss 7 months earlier from a battle they just lost the Philistines, hence the ark got captured. You just wiped out a little bit over half. You'd probably push upwards 2/3 of a tribe in a single tribe dying in less than a year's time. That's a lot. So 70 makes more intuitive sense. Okay. What we learn in chapter 8, we're moving on quite happily, actually. Now, actually, I shouldn't quite go to chapter 8. There's one thing that's actually more important in chapter 7. When the ark returned to the proper town. Samuel, this is by the way, 7 months after Eli's death. Samuel, who was there and helped and facilitate the death of Eli, the deliverance of Israel, what does he now have to do? He has to actually deliver Israel. Because the Philistines, though this was 7 months later, aren't that thrilled with Israel right now. So the Philistines come to battle and ready to wipe out the rest of the remnant of Israel and kill the rest of them off. What does Samuel now have to do? He must deliver. He must deliver them out. So Samuel becomes a deliverer. He brings up a young suckling lamb, I believe it is, female lamb, slaughters it, which is not an acceptable thing normally. Oh, yes, Anne.
It sounds like it's the feast of Sukkot. They drew water and...
It sounds like that. It's debatable. Some have argued it's near Shavuot, simply because of the time of year when the Philistines were dealing with their grain being lost. But I do note that grain harvesting happens throughout all of summer. So it could be Sukkot. It's hard to say. It's probably near one of the holidays. We just don't know sure which one. I'm probably more inclined to agree with you. It's most likely is near Sukkot. Possibly Trump. It's hard to say exactly. But it's most likely toward the fall end because of all the grain that the Philistines had lost throughout the summer by having the Ark of the Covenant with them. So probably around that time. Which would make sense with the deliverance of an ark, returning God returning the trumpets. So he does this lamb, kills the lamb, offers it, pours out water, says, God, please forgive your people, treat them as if this suckling lamb is them. None of that is prescribed in the Torah for a sacrifice. Samuel steps out of the Torah and does a sacrifice in God's name to God. Different than what God prescribed. You do not kill a suckling lamb. You wait till it's finished nursing. It must be the year old, but it cannot be still nursing. That's not allowed. Anyway, let's finish. He didn't. A female lamb at that, it's only done a few times. Again, he steps well outside the Torah and does something. Because Samuel is a seer. He sees God. He knows what God needs and wanted. He's a prophet. So when he stepped out of the Torah, he knew full well, yeah, God, I'm stepping out of your guidelines. I'm walking over here, and I know I'm still right in your eyes. And God heard. He responded, said, you're right, Samuel. You are right, and wipes out the Philistines. How is that possible? This is counterintuitive to everything we understand and know about God. Why would God allow a man to step outside of his own Torah and do something that is equally holy? And the man knows full well what should and should not happen. Yes, Jeff.
Every time a prophet does something like that, there's a message.
Yes, it is a message. And God talks to him because Samuel is a prophet. He's a seer. Or he's a visionary. He understands what God sees, desires, and wants. Much greater than Eli ever did, who was the high priest. All the sacrifices that were once done were not acceptable anyway. But Eli did everything according to the book, meaning what was allowed, what wasn't allowed in that area. And Samuel knew full well, that's not the goal of God. Over here, though it's outside of God's territory, outside what he wants, it delivers God's message to the people. That yes, he will take care of you as if you are a suckling lamb. You are an infant, you are completely helpless. He will still deliver you out. Because God, remember, wiped out everything. Took out his house, took out his home, took out all the people who were contaminated, took out the high priests, took them all out. The people had nobody left. No one to take care of them. No more shepherd left anymore. Samuel is essentially telling them, God is still here. He's still your shepherd. He'll still be there for you. So it's important we learn that Samuel delivers Israel out in that fashion through the prophet. Prophecy, that's what he's doing. But what happens immediately following, chapter 8? I say immediately following because all this stuff occurs within about a 12-year time span. So immediately following this deliverance, Israel says, we want a king. We don't want you, Samuel. You, your sons, yeah, you're okay, but we want a king, like everybody else has a king. That wonderful imagery that Samuel just delivered to them, just meaning sometime in the last few years, hard to say the exact timing, we're not worried about exact year, just delivered them and said, God will still be your shepherd, will still take care of you and deliver you, and demonstrates how he delivers. Israel responds with, we want a king. We don't need you. We don't want you. Go away. You have no value to me. So when God does this, or so when people do this, what is God's response? Exactly. Now, does God go out and kill them all for it?
No.
Funny, he did that to Moses, though, didn't he? In Moses' time, when the people said, we don't want you, God said, all right, you're dead. But in Samuel's time, people said, we don't want you. They said, okay, I'll get you king.
I'm leaving.
And he's not pleased by it. Samuel's not pleased by it. Nobody's pleased by it, meaning God and Samuel are not happy with it. But God doesn't respond the way he did with Moses. Why not? Yes, Ellie.
Education.
Education. Explain.
He's going to explain something to the people. And Samuel says, hey, God's not going to hear you. And his people said, oh, it's okay, okay. And God said, okay, let's do it.
Deliver what you want and see what you get for it.
Yeah.
Those of you who recall, our Torah includes stipulations for kings. Does it not? The Torah that is written, at least parts of it, most of it, if not all of it, prior to this event. So, did God know ahead of time that people were going to be asking for a king?
Sure.
Is that possibly one of the reasons why God was not terribly upset when they did ask for a king? Probably, if he made stipulations set up, say, okay, when you're in the land, and when you ask for a king, in the Torah says, he can do some bad things. But these are the rules he cannot do. And he lists out rules what your king cannot do. Would God have put those rules in the Torah if the people were never supposed to ask for a king or never going to ask for one? Not likely. God's usually not that short-sighted. If he planned for a king, he's not likely to be so upset when people finally ask for one. Unlike Moses' time, he did not plan to not have a deliverer. He plans to have a deliverer. And the people asking, I don't want the deliverer, that's not allowed. You have to have a deliverer. So in Moses' time, you're gone. Your request is denied. It's now been rejected. We will move on without you, essentially. Or you don't like my deliverer, tough luck, you're still gone anyway. So in Samuel's time, it's okay, versus Moses' time was not so okay. So they ask for a king, and God picks whom? Saul. Why did he choose Saul? Do you recall why he chose Saul? Physically. He was tall. He physically looked like a king. Relatively good looking. Most guesstimates put him in his mid-40s, maybe early 50s. Yes, Bill.
Was Saul king or was he ruler? David was
king. We're going to discuss that in chapter 10. we're discussing chapter 9 right now. We're going to discuss the definition of king and ruler in a minute. You're absolutely right. So they ask for a king and he chooses Saul. Now, was Saul a man after God's own heart? No. So why would God choose him? Make a point? What was that, Rose? A good person. You're right. Saul was a good person. Saul was an obedient person. He was an obedient son. He worshipped God. He trusted in God. What was his major downfall? He has a tendency to obey the will of the people at the moment in time. The fear of man or fear of looking bad. Desiring to go along with the crowd. So he was not a leader, rather he was a follower. So why would God choose a follower to lead the people? Because you need someone to prepare the way before you can have someone to deliver. The people asked for a king. They didn't specify what type of king they needed, they just asked for a king. So God chose, all right, I'm going to select the king that is good for now. As I mentioned earlier, God will take somebody, okay, I'm using you, and use, okay, I don't need you anymore, die. Next, I use you, you don't die. Next, gets rid of you after he's done using you. And that's not a bad thing. That's what God works. I mean, you're flesh and blood for a reason, so he can get rid of you quickly and not feel bad. It's a good God. Essentially, I know that sounds flippant, but I'm being somewhat serious here, that we are flesh and blood. It makes us very, very dependent upon the natural things around us and God to keep us safe and healthy. So when he doesn't need us anymore, that's fine, but we're also easily corruptible. So he can say, all right, you're going to go do this and manipulate us to do it precisely what he wants without us even knowing it. Very easy to do, not quite so easy with a spirit. You have to actually command the spirit to do it. People just kind of make circumstances around and make them think something different and make them go. Yes, Tammy.
And unlike us, he has the power of resurrection.
Exactly. So that's not that big of a deal. So what? You know, what to do? Next person? You're all going to be resurrected or talked to later anyway. So it's just a matter of time. Dad's not all the way dead. Yes, that movie. Was it the Princess Bride movie? Yes, that was comical. Mostly dead all day. Okay, so he chooses Saul. It's not a permanent king, obviously, but he's a temporary king. I'm going to have to cut this a little bit short because I'm already at 4 o'clock, practically. But Saul was still a godly person. Wasn't a great person, was a godly one. And so the series of events took place. And note, Bill pointed it correctly. God did not call Saul king until after the people said, he is our king. Then God referred to him as king. Up that point, God said, told Samuel, you will anoint a ruler, which just means a military personnel, one who will rule the military aspect of things, to act as a ruler. So does the ruler outrank Samuel? No. Samuel can still, a righteous man can outrank anybody. Samuel can still call upon the act of God and have bad things happen to this ruler and he have no defense against it. Of course, Samuel does, but that's a separate issue. But chapter 10 happens. I'm going to conclude with chapter 10. We'll continue with the other chapters later on. So Saul goes out and anoints Samuel. Actually, Samuel ends up finding him with a series of unique circumstances that happen. Losing donkeys, and Saul has to go find the donkeys, and he finds Samuel and does various other things, and a lot of things happen. I'm going to go through this rather quickly, but it's very important, so I'm hoping most of you will catch it. Saul's selection alludes to the first coming of the Messiah. You hear that? Saul's selection is the first coming of the Messiah. Not the second, but the first. And notes the various events that are supposed to happen in Messiah's life by the series of events that Samuel assigned Saul to do and observe. So try to pay attention. We're going to rattle this off rather quickly. What was Saul looking for when he found Samuel? He was looking for donkeys. Now, what are donkeys in the Torah? Beast of burden, firstborn. They're symbolic of the firstborn of a family. So Saul is looking for the firstborn. For 3 days, he looks for the firstborn. Being honored as on the third day, he's honored by Samuel, given a priestly portion, Samuel's portion, a priestly portion of a holy offering, witnessed by 30 men. You hear that? All those various numbers. That's interesting. I remember that number. I remember that witness. I remember that name. 30 men witnessed it. What was Messiah sold for? 30 witnesses against the man who sold him. And 30 witnesses against or to the man who was being sold. 30 witnesses. Saul selected a ruler, but was never actually called a king. Was Messiah selected as a ruler, but never called as a king? Called a king later, but he was selected, but he was never actually made king. That's key. The first coming, he didn't get to be made king. So the second one, did Saul ever find the donkeys? Did Saul ever find the firstborn? No, he didn't. Did the Messiah ever deliver the firstborn, all of Israel? No, he didn't. In the case of Saul's case, the father sent out, here it is, his father sent out more men, and they delivered the firstborn back home, the donkeys back home. Messiah didn't deliver the firstborn, but who did? His apostles delivered the firstborn. God sent out more men, the men through which the Messiah couldn't do, or Saul couldn't do, the father sent out more than they could do. More of them for various reasons. Saul was anointed with an oil, a flask of oil, which is an earthen vessel. What's David anointed with? A horn. What does a horn do? A horn is the king of strength. It's the power. So David's anointed with the power of God. Saul's anointed with the earth. Man on earth. My God, you're absolutely right. There's a distinction. The one is being delivered and taken here now, who is not king, but is rather just a ruler, one who's selected, the option, the one who's been chosen. David, or the second coming of the Messiah, is the one who's king, anointed with the power in the throne of God on his anointing. The tests. Saul went through a series of tests that God, that Samuel had given him. There are three witnesses to Saul's selection as being the ruler. The first witness was at Rachel's tomb. What happens at Rachel's tomb? Well, Saul goes to Rachel's tomb, and two witnesses come and tell him the firstborn had been found, meaning the donkeys had been found. They've been delivered to God. And so, of course, Saul predicts this is what's going to happen. The second witness, these are I'm referring to prophecies that Samuel gave Saul. Second witnesses, Saul went across two men, they will contain three goats, three loaves of bread, and one hin of flour of wine. What's that mean? How does that relate to Messiah? Three goats, three pieces of bread, and wine. What's a goat? What's a goat? Sin offering. What's bread? Flesh. What's wine? Blood. So you got three, a pattern of three. Sin, flesh, and life, the blood of God, blood of Messiah. These will all be delivered into Saul's eyes and he sees them. So these events are occurring as Samuel's rattling off to him. When he goes up to, so the third witness to Saul, he's been selected, which of course the third witness to Messiah, he's also been selected. These patterns of numbers, also patterns of events too. And the third witness, Saul goes to the mountain and prophesies with instruments. How does that relate to the Messiah? The Spirit of God comes and remains. That's the dove. Remember that vision? John's out there. He's supposed to baptize. He's saying he baptizes and see this, the Spirit of God like a dove coming down. And he rests and he remains. See, in Saul's case, the whole point was that the Spirit of God, the prophecy of God, the ability to prophesy, will come down upon Saul with the instruments, with wonderful blessings of music. And in Saul's case, it didn't remain, but it will come to him. In this Messiah's case, it did come. These are symbols that are actually being used and reiterated. They actually show up again in the next book, but we'll discuss those later. A few of them will show up again next book. What was the fourth witness that Saul couldn't deliver, but the Messiah has to deliver? The fourth witness is that Saul, when he goes to Gilgal, he has to sit there and wait for Samuel, wait for the righteous man to show up. And Saul doesn't make it. Saul falls short. What is Gilgal? Anybody recall what Gilgal is? Somebody rattled off. Decision point. No, that's for the north. When Israel passed across or through the Jordan River, when it was built one side, they went to Gilgal. What did they do at Gilgal?
Built the staff.
Something more important than that. Circumcised. Gilgal means rolling away. What is circumcision according to the word of God? Removing the rolling away the reproach of God from you. You may now be delivered in his presence. He will now accept you. You are not a disgusting thing to him anymore. You are now his and only his. So, in Saul's case, when he goes to Gilgal, is he able to roll away the reproach of all of Israel? He is unable. He does not wait for the righteous man to show up. He is not righteous himself. And does he wait? Of course not. Samuel, he doesn't wait. He calls it short by an hour or two short. But in the Messiah's case, when he gathers all of Israel together, as Saul did, to Gilgal to go to battle, what is the Messiah supposed to be able to do? Well, he is the righteous man. But Saul waits in Gilgal for 7 days for Samuel, which I think is symbolic of 7,000 years, but that's my personal opinion. So these various witnesses and symbols that are being used in Saul's scenario, God reuses them again in future events in the Messiah's case. So in the Saul scenario right now, he is being groomed as being the first coming or the first deliverer of all of Israel. And that's what he tries to do. Fails miserably, but tries to do. Because Saul wasn't the leader. Saul was just nothing more than a follower. Our Messiah is supposed to be a leader. And of course, the object, of course, is to destroy the enemies of God at Gilgal. So I'm going to have to cut it short. Oh, sorry. Yes.
It's just I really like one of the things you said about why did God choose Saul when he was he wasn't a man after God's own heart.
Right.
Why did he choose him? And then you said because he how did you say it?
I said a couple
I liked
things.
It, but not to remember what you said. But to prepare the way for the deliverer.
For a better deliverer.
And I was thinking about that. I was like, wow, it just opened up this new train of thought. And I remembered a similar principle in the Brit Hadashah, where it said that Yeshua was talking about, I think it was a lame man or somebody that, you know, crippled guy. And, you know, I forget who, but they were saying, this man is crippled because of his parents.
His parents, identifying something that he had done or his ancestor or earlier people had done.
But then Yeshua said, no, it is
exactly
for the glory of God. And I just thought, wow, it's the same thing there. Like, you know, because he was set, the man was not sick because of his own sin. You know, he was sick so that the deliverer could come. You know, Yeshua, he was a deliverer. I just thought that was...
And it's
cool.
A beautiful point, because you're absolutely right. In the case of Saul being selected, it gives you the contrast. All right, this is what we got. This isn't it. This isn't what we need. It's not quite right. Saul was nothing more than one that set the stage for you to identify when the better one shows up. Mm-hmm. Now we have a new, of course, David. Jonathan comes along and David comes along. But we got Messiah today, of course, is the right one we're looking at. But the whole point is that God set the stage up earlier, someone to prepare the way, and then someone who actually comes along and delivers later on.
And it also can, you can take that personally into your own life and say,
absolutely,
you know, maybe these things have happened in my life for the glory of God to be revealed later on, and for the for me to be delivered. You know, if I'm going through this thing, well, it's so that God can heal me, or so that God can show His glory, He can provide for me. If I'm having a lack of provision in my life, it's so that He can be revealed.
And you will remember it.
Yeah.
And the thing is that I've noted I've been around for, you know, 100 years or like that, but I've noted that the longer I've been around, the more I see and observe, I notice in particular myself, the things may happen to me, good or bad, I don't really care. If I don't remember them or recall, God delivered me at this point in time. Oh yeah, God delivered me there. Oh yeah, God punished me for doing that. If I don't remember them, it's a lesson I never learned. So I have to do it again. And yeah, forget not to remember those things. And in the case with Saul, written down, the case with all these people written down, the whole objective is that God's, okay, these events occurred, so you remember them when future events occur, and you'll recognize, oh, that's God's hand. I saw it here, but now this one's better. To see the improvement, to see the gain, the value. If we don't learn from our lessons, we have to repeat them, because God needs us to learn from them. That's the objective. If we do not grow, well, go ahead and die then, because you're not going to gain anything. God bless you with the remaining Shabbat. Keep you safe. Amen.